You're now listening to The Brian Callen Show with your host, Brian Callen.
We usually stop it at about an hour, but you let me know, and we'll have some fun.
We'll do it for an hour. By then, I'll be in starvation mode.
I love it. Ladies and gentlemen, our guests, Howard G. and Howard W. Buffett, they've written a book called 40 Chances, Hope in a Hungry World. And I tell you, the first thing I want to say, let's just talk a little bit about you. Your father, Warren Buffett, Howard, I'm talking to you, Howard G., gave you $1 billion and said, go out and change the world. 40 Chances is taken from a farming terminology where you were sitting at a meeting and somebody said you get 40 chances basically to turn the land over and then you give it to your children. And I think when you started writing the book, you were already 10 chances in. But more importantly, the first thing I want to say about the book is, as somebody who follows politics, as somebody who grew up in the developing world until I was 14, as somebody who follows this stuff probably a little more closely than the average actor, I'll give myself just that. I was just saying nothing. I was shocked at how much of a problem hunger still is in the world and how many people may, in fact, have enough to put in their stomach but are not getting the nutrients they need, et cetera, et cetera. And so you as a farmer decided, I'm going to go out there and change that situation.
Yeah, I mean, there's people who are hungry, and then there are people who, like you said, have access to some food, but they're undernourished. And so you may have close to 1 billion people that are hungry, and you have another couple of billion that don't really have the right kind of nutrients and protein and access to the kind of food that they should have. And, it's one of those things where when you start looking for hunger, you find it everywhere. I mean, I was watching 60 Minutes last night, and they had the World Food Program segment on about Syria. And people aren't dying from the conflict, they're dying from hunger. I mean, the conflict is creating the hunger, don't get me wrong.
Right.
But they're really dying from hunger. They're cut off from all resources. And they did a really good job of showing that yesterday. And then, in this country, it's pretty amazing how many hungry people there are. And it's easy to say, oh, yeah, there's 50 million food insecure people. But if you go down to your food bank or a food distribution, which I've done a number of times in different parts of the country, these aren't the people you think they are. Some of them are. But, when I was in Fresno a few months ago with Feeding America, earlier this year, actually, with Feeding America, I met a jet mechanic that was out of work. I met an accountant that was out of work. So some of the people that are hungry in today's world in this country are people that it's kind of shocking, to be honest with you.
Well, and I'll tell you the stories. I mean, the stories about Sierra Leone and the Congo and Guatemala with the kids who are sniffing glue. The stories that you highlight, man, it's really hard not to feel like the problem is just totally overwhelming. Because, by the way, it's not just about access to food. It's like you said with Syria. It's conflicts. It's downright dangerous to be in those countries. I mean, this guy who you were talking about in the book who flies around, where was it? And he teaches, I think it was in Uganda or something, and he's teaching them how to grow things, and he's dropping off seeds to all these different farmers. You know, what a badass. And his plane is getting peppered. And I was like, it shamed me. I was like, if there's a heaven, he's in first class, man. I'm way in the back of the line.
He's at the big kid's table.
You know what I mean, though? And so for me, I mean, here you are given this awesome responsibility. You're given $1 billion.
But let me tell you something. The best thing about that is it started with $1 billion. And then a couple of years ago, on my dad's birthday, he called my sister in his office and he said, come up and talk to me about something. And he says, you think you guys would want another $1 billion? And I thought, that's the funniest question I've ever heard. You think anybody's going to say no?
That's the greatest.
Yeah. So, most people don't understand. I'll tell you what that equates to. What it means is, because we don't have a big endowment, we have about a $300 million endowment. Which I don't mean it's not big, but it's not what we give our money from necessarily, because we get a certain amount of shares of stock every year. So this year they were worth about a little over $150 million. Next year, if it's the same price, it'll be about $165 million. So, you know, we try to give away what we get in. So yeah. It actually makes us a foundation that if you had an endowment, you would have, how big would it be? $6-7 billion.
Yeah, it'd be around yeah. 6.5.
Yeah. So the way we do it, the way we get the money, makes it a little bit of difference in how we're perceived. But it's a difficult job to give away $150 million and do it well.
And do it well is really the key word there. The key words there. That's right. I mean, one of the things I thought was very amazing, really great about the book also, was how aid can go wrong. If you've got an NGO that is giving out mosquito nets and you don't foster some kind of entrepreneurial infrastructure in that country, or just if you're building wells willy-nilly and you don't, you know, empower the local population to either be able to fix those wells or create parts for those wells. I mean, aid is not, you don't just give things. You've got to create incentive structures and institutional structures where people in those countries are actually able to self-sustain, right?
I'm sure Howie have a comment on this too, but there's no society or successful civilization that I know of that's been built on aid.
That's right.
It's been built on hard work, innovation, entrepreneurship, with the right kinds of government support and intervention that's required. And so, you know, we're never going to solve any single country's problems with aid. Now, it doesn't mean there aren't times and places where it's very useful, because there are. But Howie, you might want to comment on that, because you've had some experience with it.
Well, sure. You know, I think to tie it back to the book, we have a specific chapter. I think it's chapter 32, where it's specifically talking about how aid has the potential to create more problems than it does solve problems.
Right.
And, you know, we've done some research. We work with a great group at Texas A&M University. It's the Center on Conflict and Development. And they estimate that only 5 to 10% resources in a typical government-funded foreign assistance program directly reach the lives of the poor.
That's incredible to me. That's incredible.
When we were in Afghanistan, we looked at the amount of money the U.S. was spending on aid. Okay, so take out the military action and everything else. And, you know, the largest majority, the largest majority went to consultants, U.S. consultants that were in the country. I mean, so it comes under the category of aid. But it's not really aid.
You also talk also about the NGOs who are trading their. Well, explain that to me. And the chapter was kind of, I had to read it twice because
monetization.
Yeah, explain that.
Yeah, so monetization is one of the Western world's worst ideas, in my opinion, and I'll tell you why. So first, monetization means that you have excess commodities. So let's take corn. That's easy. And so the U.S. government buys a bunch of corn. And they actually ship the corn to a country like Niger or Chad or Malawi or wherever it is. And the NGO takes possession of the commodity. They sell the commodity where they're located in that local market, and then they get the money to help operate their office. So biggest thing that goes wrong, well, first of all, think of how inefficient it is.
Yeah.
Shipping commodities are halfway around the world so you can sell them in a depressed market. So it's the most inefficient idea you can imagine.
Yeah.
I mean, if you did that in a for-profit business, you'd be broke.
Wait a minute. Hold on. Are you gentlemen suggesting that the U.S. government is inefficient and wasteful? That's an outrage.
Well, it may be an outrage, but it may be true.
Sorry. Maybe I'm naive. Sorry.
No, but it's you guys are funny.
But the damaging effect.
The damaging effect also, it's one thing to be inefficient, but then it's another thing that quite often when you bring in commodities that aren't grown in an area and dump them into the market, think of what you do to the local farmers. I mean, think if we have all these rules in this country to keep other farm products from coming into this country to protect our farmers. Okay,
it's amazing.
Sugar is the number one. I mean, it's just like, you know, we've destroyed one of the most valuable ecosystems in the world in the Everglades, or destroyed part of it, to grow sugar when there's all sorts of really poor countries that could grow sugar very well in the environment that they have. And so politics is the single largest part of what happens with this stuff.
So Howard, what do we do about it? I mean, I know this. You've got the sugar lobby. This is what happens with Washington. It's an economy of influence. Anytime you have, protections, subsidies, you know, big companies like this, it's in their interest to lobby, petition their government, gain some influence.
But, Brian, I think you already know the answer.
I do know the answer, but it's...
Well, then you tell us.
Well, one of the things, I don't necessarily know the answer. I want to talk to you about that. But, I mean, one answer might be campaign finance reform. One answer might be, let's figure out a way to get money out of politics. Good luck. But, I mean, when you are dealing with these huge problems and you're talking about this stuff, do you find yourself just scratching your head saying, I don't know what to do, or do you know what to do?
Well,
I'm putting you on the spot here.
No, it's a good question, because it actually gets back to the root of why we wanted to write the book in the first place. So it's a perfect question. This is Howard W.
Howard.
My dad and I were sitting in Omaha, and we were talking through some suggestions that he had written for Raj Shah, who runs USAID. It's our government's aid program agency. And I was flipping through this, and we talked a little bit more about it, and eventually we got to a point where we said, look, there is so much valuable information in this piece of literature that my dad developed. Let's turn it into a book, and then let's frame it and package it in a way that we can
use it. Well, no, tell him what I want to do first, because it was the first time in your life you had to tell me to think bigger.
Well, yeah. Well, the initial idea was, okay, can we just develop this into like a workbook and then a textbook for some classrooms and kind of keep it at that? And then it was the idea, well, wait a minute, what if we can use this as a catalyst to get people's attention more broadly and start raising awareness about these challenges and then what individuals can do to solve these challenges? And then beyond that, how can we get this book into those classrooms at the graduate level, the undergraduate level, and start influencing the future leaders of these organizations and the future individuals being elected into office? So the question is, do you want to try and fix a broken system, or do you want to try and show how the system can be fixed in the future by giving the solutions and the tools and the ideas to the folks who are going to be running it 5, 10, 15 years from now? So we're trying to think about it in more than just one dynamic.
I mean, the thing that I always have to remind people of, because I never forget it. Having been, arrested in Bosnia during the conflict, having been detained in Congo for several days by the government, I mean, having gone through those things where you have no rights, you have zero rights, okay? Mm-hmm. There's no, the Lone Ranger doesn't ride in and swoop you up, okay?
Right.
So understanding how incredible this country is today. And you say that even amongst the things going on with the Ferguson incident and everything else.
Yeah.
I mean, this country is an amazing country.
Yes, it is.
And you really know that. No one walks up to me. I mean, I've had this happen 100 times. No one walks up to me and says, can you help me get to China? they all ask, how can I get to the United States? I want to come to your country. I want to come to America.
That's right.
There's a reason for that. Okay, we have a lot of big issues that we need to address and a lot of problems. Everybody knows that. But you also have to remember what this country is, what it's endured, and what the future can be. I mean, there's nowhere I'd rather live than this country.
I got to tell you, it's going to sound corny, but I'm going to say it. When you do an interview like this, you should keep yourself out of it to an extent. I read your book. I went over and hugged my kids, and I sat with my kids for a while, and I thought about how lucky I was that I live in this country, in a country with rule of law, with property rights, with the fact that I have due process and I can go to somebody if I'm feeling like my rights are violated, all that stuff. And it really brought it back to me. It's not something I have to be reminded of very often, but man, that book, just, I sat with my kids for a while, took some deep breaths, and just thought to myself, I'm the luckiest SOB alive, and I did nothing. To be that lucky.
We're all incredibly fortunate, and I think what happens is we put it in the context of our daily life, and it becomes small, and so we think smaller about it.
Yeah.
But in the context of global context, It's amazing how fortunate we are. So the point of that is, to your question, is that we still have a system that we can work within. It's frustrating at times, and you know, we're never there's some things that seem like they are very difficult to overcome. I remember when they almost overcame the part of the farm bill with the sugar program in it by one vote, you know, but there's always that one vote. So, I mean, yeah. You know, there's a lot of money in this system, and money is hard to fight against because it will buy influence to a certain degree. But we still have a system that functions, and we have one that if people really want to try to change it, they can change it. And most countries in the world do not have that.
No. And I would also, on an optimistic note, I do think that, yes, money makes it hard to change things. But the better idea, if you keep hammering it home and you keep getting it out there, out of books and into people's heads, I think the better idea ultimately wins. At least in this country it does. That's what I like to believe.
Well, the thing, you know, look at what's changed. If I look at what's changed in the last 10 years in agriculture, it's day and night from when I start. I mean,
What do you mean?
Well, I look at the innovation in technology. I look at the efficiency that we've been able to gain. I look at, you know, I mean, what I'm saying is that in this country, to your point, when you get a good idea, you can do something with it, okay? Mm-hmm. And so every day somebody's inventing something or thinking of something, and, you know, not all of those things turn out to be good for us or good for society, but you know, there are so many things that have improved society that we were having this discussion, my brother and I, and we got into the whole organic, non-organic farming and all that stuff. And I said, well, I know one thing, that from our grandparents' time, we're living twice as long, or great-grandfather. I mean, you know, so something's working. It may not be perfect, and it may not all be right, and you're going to always argue over certain things. But, you know, one of the things I did once, which is interesting, is I went back and I looked at you look at the definition of poverty in 1950 and you look at the definition of poverty in 1990. You know, poverty today is defined, do you have air conditioning? Do you have two cars or one car?
Right.
I mean the definition has changed significantly in the last 40 or 50 years. And all of those things have led to a better quality of life. So, you know, you get caught up in your own context, and sometimes you forget how far we've come.
Yeah, somebody said that. They said, settled the debate. They were having an argument. They said, okay, you like the old days? Good. Would you rather be alive before anesthesia or after anesthesia? Let's just leave it at that, baby. You know what I mean? So there it is. Well, I think, and what I like, again, about the book is that it does end on an optimistic note. I mean, you guys give us a lot of examples of where it might be one person, but they're making a difference, where these ideas are taking hold. And one of the things that I kind of took from the book was, if you get on the ground and you go in and you actually start educating farmers about how to seed or whatever, if you help somebody start a business, a mosquito net business, it makes a very big, significant, tangible difference, right?
Well, one of the things we're trying to do in Ghana right now, and then Howie might tell you, it's in the book, but he might rehash for a minute a little bit of what he did in Afghanistan. But, you know, in Ghana, we've been trying to figure out conservation agriculture is a key thing. And in Africa, you have the most depleted soils in the world, and obviously depleted soils don't grow much. So how do you improve the soils? It's not just good seed or fertilizer. You know, you got to look at the whole system. So we're trying to figure out, it's hard to get people to do something that takes more work when they don't really know for sure what the outcome is. And that's part of changing people's behavior in farming. So, you know, we're working with John Deere. I'm blown away that they're where they are on this, because I just never thought you could get a company that big to care this much about the different farmers in the world. But we're working with them on this idea to do to provide different incentives on a commercial basis to get farmers to use better farming techniques in terms of conservation agriculture, and so that they don't plow the soil, so it doesn't erode, so that they maintain cover to build organic matter, all the things that create a better environment to farm. Now, when you start doing that with a company that size and they're serious about it, it actually gives me hope that we can do something, that we can get traction, that we can do it at scale. I mean, the key in the end is, whatever you're doing, wherever you're doing it, can you do it at scale? Because you can,
well, what do you mean by scale? What do you mean?
Well,
by that?
You can come. We probably spent $150 million learning a really difficult lesson. We did a bunch of different ag projects in Africa, and they're 3 years, 4 years, 5 years. And they're, 300 people, 500 people, maybe 3,000 people. But none of those things, when we went home, when the money ran out, we went home, you could go back today, and I think it'd be pretty depressing to see what the results are, because we didn't change the agricultural policy. They didn't bring in rural electrification or roads, or they didn't provide, they can't afford to buy or purchase better seeds or inputs, because it wasn't a sustainable, scalable approach.
Right.
And so unless, I learned this lesson really hard. I learned it in Angola. It's in the, I talk about it in the book, yep, when the woman tried to give me her child. You know, I just realized you can't save people by giving them things. You can save people by doing things that allow them to save themselves, which means you have to change policy.
Yep.
Governments have to behave. You know, if you've got a government that has a leader, well, you can't really call them a leader, but the person in charge.
Yeah.
And they are better off because the rural population is fragmented and less literate, because they can get money from oil or diamonds or platinum or whatever it is and control the natural resources to their personal benefit, and then they spread that wealth around a little bit. How do you overcome that? I mean, that corruption is so difficult.
We had Darren Acemoglu and his co-author, who wrote a book called Why Nations Fail. And it's a really important book. I recommend it to both you guys, because that's exactly what he talks about. These are called extractionist economies, extractionist institutions. They take from the land, and they don't redistribute that wealth back into their own population. They don't need their own population's wealth to keep them afloat.
And they don't need their votes, and that's the key thing.
Right. Yeah. Right. So there's no fear of the local population. They can do whatever they want to them. That is the legacy of most of the developing world, and it isn't necessarily changing. It certainly isn't changing fast enough. But there is reason for hope. I mean,
but I think that so much of this also comes down to, what are we focused on? Because for the American public, for the European public in general, we're like, oh, they're starving. Let's dump a bunch of aid in there. And increasingly, there are voices like yours, and you also mentioned in the book Dambisa Moyo, who are saying that's actually about the worst thing you can do.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, the difficult part of that is that you're reacting emotionally. And you also want to feel, there's a part of us in human nature that makes us want to feel like we're doing the right thing, and we want to feel good about it. Mm. And so I would say half of what people do, and I'm guilty of this too, I mean, people do things because they feel good about it. It's not necessarily because it's always the right thing to do. And so, you know, if you wanted to be tough about it and give them some tough love, you would say, you know, if enough people go hungry, I get bad letters after I say this, but I mean, if enough people go hungry, that government's going to have to do something.
Yeah.
And so if we take the pressure off that government and we just do it over and over and over, you know, that's a pretty tough lesson. Now, I will also tell you, I've seen too many hungry people that I would be a pretty big hypocrite on that statement, because I don't think you can watch people suffer and not try to address whatever that issue is, particularly if it's hunger. So it's an innate challenge for as a human being that you want to respond to the need, especially when you have the means to respond. And you do that because the short term demands you do that. And the short term reaction interferes with a long term solution. And that's what you see.
But I think that's the thing, is that 50 years into, you know, serious development efforts, and that's part of what you talk about in the book, you know, a lot of Africa has been starving for a long time, and we've been trying to fix it by, you know, sending money, sending food aid, and all of that sort of stuff. And now there's certainly enough data that we have to seriously reflect on whether we're really helping these people.
Well, and obviously the answer is that just giving aid. But aren't we getting smarter about that, guys? Aren't we getting smarter? I mean, isn't there... You give us some examples. I mean, NGOs are starting to learn that, aren't they?
Well, yes and no, and it goes beyond just the NGOs, and this is right back to what my dad was saying. So you do have 10 countries in Africa that are meeting their Maputo goals. They're meeting their minimum threshold of investment in rural and agricultural development, and they either already have or on track to have extreme poverty by 2015.
Right, so, because they're doing it. I think it's 10% is the Maputo rule, and you think it should be up to 30%.
Well, for certain countries, yeah, it definitely needs to be. I mean, think back to 1864 in the United States when President Lincoln established USDA and completely changed the fabric of our country with the land grant institutions and with the Homestead Act and everything that was going on at that point. I mean, so, yes, these countries would do far better for their citizens if they were having a higher level of investment in rural and agricultural development. There's no question.
But I'll throw cold water on that a little bit, and I totally agree with that. But until you have property rights and rule of law, it just doesn't matter what you do almost.
We work
in the toughest countries in the world, okay? And we have spent about $140 million in one province, North Kivu, in eastern Congo. Now, we started building a $20 million hydroelectric plant in the middle of the conflict. Okay, and, you know, occasionally we'd get an email from Emmanuel. He would say, well, an RPG hit the bulldozer, but we got the track back on and we got the parts to fix it. I mean, that's the environment. Okay,
yeah.
Now, you know, you can look at this 100 different ways and you can say, well, you know, our approach was we're not going to wait until the conflict is over, because the problem is people's lives are going on every day now. Okay,
yeah.
No one gets put on hold because of the conflict. So, you know, we decided to make these investments. Some of them are very risky. Some of them are really paying off now. But one of the reasons was because we felt that if there was a peace agreement accord, then, you know, there would be an immediate way to put these soldiers to work. There'd be an immediate reintegration program. And unfortunately, the politics get in it. I mean, it's one of the most disappointing experiences I've ever had, and it's just kind of panned out over the last year, to see people who are in decision-making positions, some of who have their own agenda, some of who are just so risk-averse to take a chance because it might affect their, you know, future in their profession or whatever. And then others.
Are you talking about people that are actually in power in countries like Congo, or?
I'm talking about people who are in power in Congo. I'm talking about people who are provided opportunities through certain processes. I don't want to name names, but they're provided opportunities through certain processes to be in a position to help negotiate. And it was the most disappointing thing I'd ever seen. I mean, basically, you know, people are scared to take the risk to try to solve a really challenging program because of what might happen to them. Mm-hmm. And that's understandable. And some people are probably right in that decision just because they have a family to feed too, and they have to watch out for what they do. But I just think if you're willing to take on a big title and take on a position that's supposed to be for public benefit, not personal gain, then you take the risk or don't take the job.
Yeah. Well, then when you're dealing with places like Congo, the stories, the insanity, that place hasn't caught a break since Leopold came in there. I mean, you know what I mean?
You're
it's
right.
Like, I don't even know what to say about that place. I literally, I swear to God, I followed that conflict for a long time. I followed the conflict in Liberia and Sierra Leone well before Blood Diamond and all that stuff. I remember thinking to myself, listen, all we need is get some crack special forces teams. Hunter's going to shake his head. Get some crack special forces teams in helicopters. And anytime you see a truck full of thugs that are coming in to kill and torture a bunch of villagers, take those bastards out. Shoot them in the face. I don't care what you do. Like, I just feel like there's certain things to aid where if you got thugs, murderous thugs like Joseph Kony, find him, kill him, and figure out a way to create perimeters around those villages. And if they really are starving, start by giving them some food, mosquito nets. And then when you've got them stabilized, when people have food and they're not terrified that they're going to get their arms cut off, for God's sake, then maybe you can have some progress. Until then, there's basic human needs, man.
Well, you mentioned Kony. We've been involved the last few years in an effort to try to help support those who want to come out of his group. And
well, you met his top lieutenant, right?
Well, I met his general, Caesar Chellum, yeah.
He's a real sweetheart, isn't he?
I'll tell you, those are the experiences that I think really help you kind of understand how difficult this is. Because here's a guy that when I first met him, he's standing with his wife and his child, sweet little kid. And if you didn't know who he was, you wouldn't think anything of it. Hmm. And then you look in his eyes, and this guy is just steel cold. I mean, I can't imagine the things that he did to people. And, the thing that is hard to understand is what people do to other people. They're actually innovative in how they make people suffer. We have a farm in South Africa, and we've had a number of neighbors that have been killed. And some of the ways that they've been killed, I wouldn't have ever thought of doing it. I mean, it's really
this is in South Africa,
this is in South Africa. I mean, one of the things they do in South Africa if they get riled up is they put a tire over you so you can't do anything with your arms, and they throw gasoline and burn you.
Yeah, neck collar. Yeah.
Yeah, but exactly. Yeah. But I mean,
listen to me, like I've done it. Ah, yeah, it's called a neck collar. What do you got? Yeah, well, I mean, you know.
What frame of mind do you have to be in to do that? And once you start doing it, how do you get somebody to stop it? I don't know. Conflict is one of the greatest contributors to hunger on the continent of Africa.
Yeah.
And half of the countries on the continent have either been in conflict or are in it currently in the last, decade or so. And so conflict is one of those things where if you really wanted to get tough and crack down on it, you get into all sorts of issues. You get into sovereignty issues. One of the most difficult things today is with the kind of technology we have in terms of weapons is there's the means to have a lot of innocent casualties, collateral damage, as they call it. And that makes it difficult to address. And people who want to fight against establishments or democracy or the U.S. or, whoever it is, they understand those techniques work. And so it makes it I happen to think Chuck Hagel, I don't want to get into politics, but I think Chuck Hagel was right when he said ISIS is something that we've never really faced before.
Yeah, that's right. And I remember when it was brewing in Syria and everybody's like, well, should we arm the good guys against these bad guys? Well, I've heard that whole narrative before. It doesn't usually work out.
The problem is you don't know who the good guys
exactly.
are.
Exactly. And if you're going to get involved in that situation, you better know that culture and that history inside and out. And we've had a number of experts on Iraq on this podcast, and that always comes up time and again. Most people just were ignorant to what was the realities on the ground, the history, the culture, all that stuff.
Well, and I mean,
most of the time, most of us don't know the realities on the ground. And the reason why, for the last few years, I had to Congo again for my sixth trip this year, and actually, there's something wrong with me because I'm going to celebrate for the fourth time. I'm going to celebrate my birthday in Congo. There's something wrong.
You're a good man. You're a good man. You could be sitting back drinking champagne. You're trying to make a difference.
The thing is that Well, my wife does that, but the reason is because every single time I've been there,
yeah,
it is very different. Okay, there it's never constant. Now, I can't do that the rest of my life, and I'm not going to do it the rest of my life. But it gives me an understanding that things change. And when we were talking about the bad guys, how I said, well, not only can you not tell the good guys the bad guys, but sometimes the good guys change. So I mean, you know,
yeah, that's right. But you've spent time in Goma and these places where a lot of these atrocities went on for 10, 20 years, right?
Oh, I'm usually not in Goma. I'm usually way outside of Goma up into the Virungas and in Rumangabo and other places.
And you don't know whether or not you're going to come across one of these militias that decides to come in and just chop your head off or whatever.
But they won't. They, I mean, I've met with a number of rebels before, and they don't. It doesn't really work that way typically. I mean, it might in the Middle East. Don't get me wrong.
So then, what is it? What is it that when I read about, you know, the Lord's Resistance Army coming in and killing, you know, all these villages? What's going on? Why the ferocity and violence? Who are they killing? Is there a methodology? What's going on?
Oh well, yeah. I mean, you mentioned Blood Diamonds. I mean, if Howie was with me a few years ago, it's been a while, and we went and interviewed. It was very difficult to do, actually. In fact, this is kind of an interesting story because I don't want to put Howie on the spot, but I will.
Do it. do it. Get ready, Howie.
But, you know, we were sitting in Kabbala, Sierra Leone, meeting a guy who'd been a colonel. I can't even define it. I get so confused. I mean, he was in the military, then he was in another rebel group, then he was in the RUF, and I couldn't track it all, but we were having a conversation with him because he was going to take us the next day, and the next day was an amazing day from 6 a.m. to 6 p.m. and interviewed a number of young kids in different situations that had been in the war. And these were all kids who had participated in killing people. And then in the next few days, we met people who had a lot of arms and legs chopped off. And so we were sitting there talking to this colonel for at least an hour, and it was just this normal conversation. And one of the things that came out of it was this guy saw nothing wrong with what he had done. And he told us stories about throwing babies down well shafts. He told us stories about locking people in houses and burning the house down, keeping the youngest kid out, watching and watch it, and say, basically, you can have the same fate or, you know, you can come with us
and fight.
Jesus. And we'll teach you how to kill. And if you don't like killing, we'll put you on drugs and then you'll kill. So the point is, we walked away from this, and Howie was like, "Dad, how can you have anything to do with somebody like that?" And I think that, you know, that's a challenge we all face if we're trying to get to the truth. And I said to him, I said, "The only way that I can interview these kids is for him to take me to them, because they won't talk to me otherwise, and I wouldn't be able to find him."
Right.
And so I said, you know, I'm compromising on, yeah.
You're talking to a monster, a sociopath.
Talking to a terrible person, yeah. a terrible person.
What happens to these guys? Do these guys go to jail, or they're just walking around free?
Well, in this case, he's walking around. I mean, there, you know, it's. You know, what would you do if you put them in jail? They don't have the money to run an operated jail. I mean, they don't.
Chaos. Just I mean, true chaos. True.
They don't have a system to do it.
Well, there's no government, right? I mean, there's no real government to speak of.
Well, they're getting better. There wasn't much when I was there. But you know, when you sit down and you talk to people who, I mean, I had a guy. We stopped and visited a. They call it an amputee village. It's where a lot of the amputees from the RUF. I mean, it's amazing how accurate Blood Diamonds was in a lot of ways. And so you talk to these people who are just trying to survive, and this one guy brings his kid around, and his kid's missing both arms, and he says, "My son has lost both his arms because I said the wrong thing to one of these guys and pissed him off." I mean, how would you like to live with that for your life?
I
mean,
I couldn't.
It's just, and these guys are just trying to survive. And so I think when you're in the field like that, it's hard to take sometimes, and it makes you realize that the world's pretty screwed up in a lot of places, and it's not easy to fix.
Well, one of the real changes there seems to have been in development is a move towards not just what do we have to teach the farmers, but what do the farmers have to teach us. You know, William Easterly's book, The Tyranny of Experts, there's this real thread that essentially these NGOs have sat in their offices and not done the sort of on-the-ground work where they really go and see what's happening locally.
Well, I'll say two things to that. Number one is there's two sides to that. One is that we're in this little battle right now on an advocacy campaign because I'm so tired of reading these academic analysis that say this works, this doesn't work, and the guy has never been in a farm. He's never, you know, he doesn't have a clue as to what it takes to make it work. So, you know, to that point, I would say we need real life field experience expertise. We don't need people sitting in offices that have read books or taken a class, and that's all fine, but not to base outcomes on that. And the other thing, as I would say, is, which isn't always popular among everybody, is that the truth is, if you can't go ask Mozambique farmers what they want because and think that that's the solution. Those farmers have been through a conflict. They have lost most everything they had. A lot of them are not literate. They've never had a single ounce of training in agriculture. So you can't. At that level, you can't say, let's go ask the Mozambique or Ghanaian farmers or whoever it is what they want, because they don't know what they want. They don't know what's available. They haven't had the opportunity we've had. So it kind of, or soil. They don't even, I mean, I asked a woman in Kenya once who had this great looking corn, and I said, how do you get this corn? She says, the government. I said, well, how did the government didn't grow your corn? How do you get, I mean, you know, and she said, no. It's a political year, so they gave me fertilizer. And I said, well, what? And she knew this. She said, this year I'll get it because there's elections. The next 3 years I won't.
Jeez.
And so I said, well, what fertilizer? She says, I don't know. It comes in a little bag. I have no idea what it is. I said,
NPK.
Yeah. Well, she says it's NPK. I said, do you know what NPK is? She says, I have no idea. And so then I said, have you ever had a soil test? She has no idea what a soil test is. So, I mean, You have to realize that you're starting at multiple levels. We divide farmers, and this is a very simplified thing to do, but we have a little pyramid, and we divide them, and we've done this based on real-life experience, you know, into four different categories. And the truth is, when you have this very small part of the top that's like 3 to 5%, and they're commercial farmers, they're fine. They don't need us. You get to the next group, and it's maybe 5 to 10%, and they're like, they have market access. They do okay most years. They experience a few hunger periods. You get in the next group, and it's maybe 10 or 15%. And they're the ones that we focus on today because they're the ones we think we can permanently pull out of poverty by certain things. Now, you go below that, which is a probably at least 50% of the pyramid, and I couldn't tell you what to do with those farmers other than charity. And charity won't solve the problem long term.
Well, I mean, but you could start by teaching them the basics, right?
But you really can't because you don't have the infrastructure to access it. They don't have the money to benefit from it.
Right.
I mean, it's you're talking about subsistence farmers that have nothing.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's one thing that I kind of was eye opening. I never thought about this country has infrastructure, waterways, and data sharing, and all that stuff. I don't know anything about farming.
But you know what? You know, one of the things though that's really interesting is if you fly, I mean, organization counts. Okay, so if you fly over Nebraska, you have perfect roads, other than maybe when you get into the Sandhills or something. But you have perfect roads in all the farming communities. It's a mile by mile. There's 640 acres in every square that you look at. And there's a way to run electrical poles down, and there's roads that get you to the next place. I mean, organization counts. You drive through most cities of many developing countries, and you can't. There's total chaos just trying to drive a car, let alone, you know. So,
and this is all in 2014, you know.
Yeah. So I mean, but organization counts. I mean, when you lay something out and you organize it, you are more efficient. You can do more with your money. You can make things work better. And so, you know, we've done a pretty good job in this country of doing that.
Even on a more fundamental level, I mean, that's the better the roads are, the further the markets that you can access before your food rots, so that you have far better access to markets.
Yeah, there's another here. I'm going to put Ari in the spot again. He's going to hang the phone up. we were in a program. We went to I think it was Ivory Coast, and we went to this program with the World Food Program, and it was a food for work program. And as we were driving out there, Howie is saying to their dad, this isn't right. You're making people work for food. And I said, well, just wait and get out here. We'll talk to some of the people, and you'll get a different idea. So we got out there, and they were actually, what made me think of this when you're talking about the access to markets, so they were building roads over areas that prevented them from, I mean, these are not, they're bridges. They're not big, complicated bridges, but, you know, they're building these bridges so that they have better access and the roads are more passable the entire year. And so it prompted me, because of Howie's comments, it prompted me to ask some other questions that I probably already thought I knew the answer to, but I just said to someone, I said, what's this meant to you? And, you know, they start telling their stories about how this is the only way we have access to food. This makes us proud, because we're not just doing something. We're earning this, okay? We're earning this, and in the end, it helps everybody. And so, you know, it just shows how easy it is to make an assumption about something without knowing how the other people feel. And, you know, we support a lot of food for work programs, the World Food Program, because it's a great currency. Isn't what they need. They need food, but they also want to be, people want to be productive. And it's really, they've been some pretty good programs.
But so you guys, look, I mean, we've spent 45 minutes talking about just how impossible some of these issues are. And we talked about how important property rights are and stuff, but you guys have been given a huge responsibility. Here's $1 billion. You're not walking away from that.
$2 billion.
Practically and counting.
And going up.
So now it's like, do you ever feel like, why me? I mean, because what keeps you going? You're going to the Congo on your birthday for the fourth time. Howie, you could do anything else, but now it's on your shoulders as well. You're a young guy. You've got to do something about the world. What keeps you guys going? I mean, do you feel like you're making progress? And my second question is, what can people like us do?
Well, I'll answer the first one because I'm the one going to Congo, and he can answer the second one because I don't know the answer. But I'm kidding. But, you know, for me, my entire life, I've just had to see things. And so I have been driven so many times to just, I want to be there. I want to smell it. I want to see it. And I've never been too, I try not to be reckless, although some people would say I'm reckless, but it doesn't bother me to walk into a conflict environment. I've been scared a few times. I mean, I've had three times I have an AK-47 in my chest, once an Uzi, and I always say I look to see where the trigger finger is when it's in my chest. But, you know, I've been in a couple situations in Bosnia where I was in a minefield. I got in a minefield by accident. I mean, but those things don't bother me, because I guess I just feel like if the people I'm trying to understand, if that's their environment, that's the context of their life, that's how they live, how can I possibly get a small sliver of understanding of that if I'm not there? Now, I'm going to be 60 on this birthday. I'm going to have to cut some of this stuff out. I mean, I can't do this forever. But I've done it for a long time, and I've learned a lot from it. And, you know, I just feel like I need to be there to see it and understand it. Now, everybody doesn't feel that way. Howie, you can answer the second question.
Well, yeah, you know, I think I've reflected a lot on this, you know, going through this process. You know, my dad and I, we traveled, I don't know, we've probably been 60, 70 countries together. I've lost count, and doing it since I was maybe 12 or 14. And
wow.
And it's been a tremendous experience. And, you know, being able to sit down and write 40 chances together, I mean, it's, you know, mostly his words, but to really have a collaborative project has given us the opportunity to reflect on things that, and in ways that we hadn't done before. It was a completely different kind of journey for us. And to answer your question, I'll say that part of that reflection for me has been sitting back and looking at what my grandfather has been able to accomplish in his lifetime and think about how a single man can grow what at one point was the world's biggest fortune and then turn around and turn it into history's greatest gift and give it all away, and to do it in a way that has empowered others, specifically my father in the context of my experiences, to go out and to learn and to change the world and to do great things with it. And then I spent those however many years right next to my dad watching him do that. And what it's shown me is that anybody can rise to a position in life to affect change. And I promise you, it doesn't matter if it's at your community level, your state level, your national level, or at a global level. I know that a single individual can do it. And that is what has kept me going.
And that's what the book is about.
That's what the book's about. We have 40 chances to do that, to build a legacy that we want to leave behind, or to empower our children or others that are around it, whatever it is. It doesn't have to be a specific prescription. But the point is, it can be done. We've got countless examples from years and years and years past, amazing leaders that have just grown out of nothing and gone on to make great changes for humanity, civilization, and the world. And so when you have those examples, you know what the potential and possibility is. And it's about seizing that. It's about recognizing that you do have these limited number of chances to do it, and then being thoughtful and contemplative, but taking risks and really working to make a difference. I think that's what it's about. And that's what I've learned from my dad.
Well, I love that answer. I love that answer. And I think that's the value of the book, as you said. And 40 chances, hope for a hungry world.
But now on a lighter note, I have to tell you that his very first trip to Africa, one of us can't do math because I thought he was 12 and he thinks he was 14, but or 13. I thought he was 12. But anyway, February 97. And so we're at this camp. It's called Abu's Camp, and it was up in Botswana. And we were in this tent, and they're spread out quite a bit. And it's just this little tent. It's not a fancy thing. And we're laying there, and it's about 9 o'clock at night. And all of a sudden, we hear this little poof, 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 poof. And then poof. And it's like, ooh, something's outside.
Something big, yeah.
And then I don't know if you ever hear a lion roar.
Yes, I have.
It's impressive, okay? Yeah. And Howie looks at me, Dad, what do we do? And I said, stop talking. I mean, it was like, that was his very first experience.
That's great.
And I'll tell you, we laid there for 3 hours,
yeah.
And it was like neither one of us, we both probably had to pee like crazy, but neither one of us were going outside.
No way. Not with a 400-pound cat. No thanks.
Yeah, so, but, you know, it's just, the reason I tell that story is because if anybody listens to this and their parents, the coolest thing you can do, the greatest thing you can do is take your kids somewhere, it doesn't have to be Botswana, but take them where, you know, especially now, where, you know, maybe the cell phones don't work, maybe they don't have a Game Boy, maybe the Game Boy's old stuff, whatever the new stuff is. But you know, it's really having the time, the personal time with your kids is really important. And I think that's harder and harder to get these days.
Yeah, but it gives you perspective.
You have to make it happen.
Yeah.
You have to make it happen. Yeah. And it's really worth it.
Well, I agree. And one of the things I wanted to say and add to what Howie W. said about, talking about making a difference is that a lot of times it may feel like you're making no difference at all. It may feel like you're, you know, punching it in the wind. But I do believe that there is something called momentum, and there's a tipping point, and things happen. And whether you know it or not, if enough people just take those small steps and move in the right direction, that is how Latin America went from military dictatorships across the board to democracies. They might be messy democracies, but nobody called that. Nobody saw the Berlin Wall falling the way it did, the Soviet Empire crumbling the way it did so quickly. So I think that the value of people like yourselves who are willing to get out there, go to Congo on your birthday or what have you.
It hey, makes they have good cake and ice cream there.
Is that right? Well, there you go, baby. There you go.
Well, that's where the really chocolate's going. From.
Yeah,
so.
That is where the chocolate's from. So there it is. Well, anyway, gentlemen, you guys could be sitting on your yacht and doing things that a lot of rich people do and you don't. And I appreciate that. And, you know, one of the things I said to Hunter as I was reading the book is I texted him and I said, this podcast, we have people on this podcast that are making a difference. And I think you both are making a difference. Thank you for your time. And thank you for having the courage to do things like go to Congo,
etc. I appreciate it. I'm gonna give you one. You mentioned something about how you never know you're gonna make a difference. I'm gonna give you one example before we hang up.
Please,
okay.
Please.
So Howie and I are on a book tour, and we go to Cargill, and there's about 300 Cargill employees, and we do this moderated, discussion for maybe an hour or so. And we get done, and this young girl walks up to me, and she says, she introduces herself. Now I wish I'd gotten a card, wrote her name down. I'm really mad at myself for this. But she walks up to me, and she says, you wouldn't know who I am, but I wouldn't be here today if it weren't for you. And I thought, okay, I'm waiting for the rest of it. I mean, I'm not sure what that means. And she says, you provided a scholarship for Mexicans in either Chiapas or Oaxaca to go to Zamorano University in Honduras. And she said, I was one of those people who got that scholarship. And she said, today I'm a biologist here at Cargill in Minneapolis. And I thought, wow. I mean, that's, you know, it might not mean anything to anybody else listening to this, but when you have somebody come up and you've known, and I've had this happen in way less elegant circumstances too, but when you actually make that connection with that individual, that you change their life. I mean, you changed what they could do with their life, and they had the potential to do it, and they had the desire to do it, but they didn't have the means to do it. And you gave them the means. They did the work. I always say we do the easy part. And so, you know, when you have that kind of experience, it really makes it worth it, because it is so easy to, and that was a challenge in writing this book, is it's so easy to get overwhelmed. It's so easy to think, how can you possibly solve all these problems? And I feel like that sometimes, but I also realize I can't give up. When you meet somebody like this, and I've had it happen a few other times in Africa, it's an amazing experience, and it's worth it. And, you know, like Howie said, you can do that in your own community. You can do that at a food distribution, at a food bank, at a soup kitchen, and you'd be amazed at the change that you can make in somebody's life just by paying attention to them, just mm-hmm. by mm-hmm. making them realize that you noticed them, that they're not insignificant, that you know they're on somebody that somebody cares about them, and I've seen it, I've seen that, and I'll tell you, it's well worth it. So if anybody's listening to this and go, well, I can't do much, go down to the soup kitchen and volunteer. Go down to a food distribution. Call, find out. Go to your local food bank and tell them you want to help. It's a really rewarding experience. I will tell you, sometimes it's when you first walk in there, depending on what community you're in and what group they're serving, it can be uncomfortable.
Yeah.
It can be very uncomfortable. But pretty soon, you start to realize, you know, this is a great place to be. This is a great thing to be doing. And these people they're all human beings. And what the time I'm spending on this is worthwhile, and it's going to make a difference in somebody's life. And you can do that in your own community. And I think that's the most important message, is you don't have to go off to Congo and have birthday cake. You can do that.
But you are, and we thank you for it. I love it.
All right.
Howard G., Howard W. Buffett, thank you, gentlemen. Thank you for taking all that money and making the world a better place. You are welcome back anytime. I don't know if you like stand-up comedy. People tell me I'm very funny. And I'll be in Philadelphia December 10th through the 13th at Helium doing stand-up. Where are you guys calling me from, and where do you spend most of your time? Besides in all the hot spots.
No, we're in Decatur, Illinois at the moment.
I might be doing stand-up somewhere around there. I'll let you know.
Well, let me know if you're close, because we'll come heckle you.
That's what I like to hear, baby. I'll be like, hey, what's with the billionaires in the corner heckling me? This is an outrage. I'm not going to take this crap. Go make the world a better place. Go back to the Congo, Buffett.
Okay, man. That's where I'm headed.
All right,
thanks
guys.
Thank you very much.
Be safe. We'll talk to you later, man.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye, guys.
Thanks, guys.
Thanks. There it is, ladies and gentlemen. Talking to billionaires like it's nothing. Me and Hunter Motz. Good men. That's crazy, man. I don't know what to say. I mean, the book is harrowing. And I, you know, when I read about how, you know, just what people do to other people, man, they highlight a lot of that stuff. And you're dealing with huge problems, but they can be fixed. You and I were talking. There is an answer. There is a solution. And things get done. You just got to have the balls, the tenacity, the patience, the smarts to figure your way through. Keep changing your approach. Keep changing your approach.
And I would say part of that is the humility. It's the willingness to not be an ideologue and, you know, dogmatically stick to one side or the other.
But if you're always right?
Well, Brian, like that's me. A unique problem to you.
Okay, because I'm always right.
Now, Brian, are you the Pope or are you God?
Here's the thing. I've read the Bible. I know I'm funnier than Jesus. Like, I'm not trying to be obnoxious, but I am funnier than the Lord.
I would say you're probably funnier than everyone in the Bible.
That's right. Oh, by the way, ladies and gentlemen, my podcast with Tim Ferriss just dropped.
That's exciting.
Yeah. One of my favorite people, Tim Ferriss, and I'm doing so listen. Apparently I talk about eating corgis. I don't remember that. But I guess I do. I eat dogs.
You do get excited.
I do, ladies and gentlemen. I say a lot of things.
And you are a Korean.
I am a Korean. I'm not going to touch that. The Koreans Koreans don't eat dog, but...
No, they do.
They do. Okay.
I've only had dog once in
my
life.
You have eaten dog.
Oh, I've eaten dog.
You're a dog eater.
And it was at a Korean restaurant in Beijing.
How was it?
Gamey. Yeah. They served it in like little strands.
You're not supposed
with
to eat carnivores.
Sauce.
Dogs are scavengers, and I guarantee they carry trichinosis.
I don't think that's the issue. They're just not tasty. I feel the same way about dog as whale. Yeah. If you just let everybody eat some, no one will ever want to eat it again.
I bet. It's like a fishy steak.
Yeah, whale's like fishy steak. Yeah. Whale's actually pretty tender, but dog is just stringy.
What was that? What was that Eskimo ice cream you were talking about?
Oh, muktuk.
Mmm.
Muktuk.
That's whale blubber with some berries thrown in.
Yeah.
Why couldn't I have been born in the Arctic?
Yeah,
two places I don't want to be. The Arctic and in Congo.
Yeah, anywhere with jungle. Jungle is terrible.
You can keep jungle.
Yeah, jungle
you
is terrible.
You can keep jungle and all that awful conflict. Yeah. I just hole up with a whole bunch of guns and wait for the assholes and just let loose.
Would you eat lead, you maggots?
I swear to God, I spend probably 20% of my day, and I'm not kidding, wishing I were an avenging angel. I want to be just jacked, bandoleros. I want big machine guns. I want to be able to fly. Give me a contraption like a drone, silent drone. I will fly over those conflict zones and just shoot shitheads and save all those innocent villagers. That's what I want to do.
Yeah.
When I go back in time with an RPG, or better yet, a shoulder-launched missile, one of those things that you take tanks out at, and I want to go find whenever those Hutus are coming in to kill all the Tutsis in their trucks, take them out. Just shoot right at the truck. Kadoosh, kadoosh. Just get the word out. If you're in a truck with all your asshole friends with machetes and you think you're going to kill a bunch of people,
you better watch
there's
out
a
for
dude
the flying
named
white
Brian
man.
The Kid Callen who's going to fucking kill you.
Yeah, watch out for the flying white man
hey,
with the RPG.
Doesn't have to be white. I'll bring a bunch of my black friends, and they'll do it with me. But the bottom line is, fuck those guys.
But Brian, in your fantasy, is it better if you're doing it with help or if you're doing it solo?
Of course solo.
Yeah.
I want to kill that general that he was talking about, too. I hate that guy. Fuck you, Mr. General. You're the biggest shithead on the planet. I hope you die slow. Anyway, that's what I have to say. Ladies and gentlemen, once again...
Brian Callen takes a controversial stand against warlords.
He wants to kill all of them. Good job. He wants to be an avenging angel in some kind of weird contraption. Da-da-da-da-da-da! Making the world a better place.
You've been listening to The Brian Callen Show with Brian Callen. Be sure to like him on Facebook. Just search for Brian Callen Comedy. And follow him on Twitter. Just search for @BrianCallen. You can also find him online by visiting his website. Just go to briancallen.com. Until next time, bye-bye.